Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Gunther Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm happy to bring to you Bruegel's podcast today with Esther de Lange. Esther de Lange is a member of the European Parliament and the vice chair of the EPP group in the European Parliament, the biggest group of the European Parliament. And she is also a member in a number of delegations and committees, for example, in the Delegation on Relations with the People's Republic of China. But also she has been working very closely on transatlantic issues and is very interested in the transatlantic relation. Thank you, Esther, for joining us. We want to discuss the transatlantic relation and what it all means for Europe and Europe's place in the world. So thanks again, Esther, for joining.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be here.
So Esther, let me throw this first question at you, which is really about what do you make out of the election in the United States? Is it a big relief? It's a great moment for Europe, or will not much change? How do you see things?
Well, of course, American elections are always interesting to watch, right? Although, honestly, I wish the media in my member state, the Netherlands, would give as much attention to elections in Germany, for example, than they do to the ones in America. What happens in Germany economically might be even more relevant to the Dutch economy. But anyway, I know the American elections are, of course, always a circus. Friday morning, I found my 9-year-old son who had apparently gotten up very early without me knowing. I found him in front of CNN watching the spread in Georgia. Even he was drawn into this whole circus. Two things. Of course, I am personally very relieved that we have somebody in the White House who basically respects the general rules of politeness about sticking to the truth over lies, etc. And I do think that for the relationship with Europe, it means two things. Joe Biden will be more inclined to be polite to Europe, to remain in contact with Europe. And that is generally perceived as a good thing. However, Trump also provided some shock therapy in the sense that we have known since 1989 that we have to do more in terms of our own defense. Obama said so politely. Donald Trump started questioning Article 5 of NATO, so that's a different style. But it did get us to act on a European level. And what I'm maybe a bit concerned about is that there might be those who are now kind of lulled into inaction again, because, you know, they rely on the transatlantic relation to be as before, or maybe even before the fall of the wall, which is the automatic friendship, the automatic big brother, you know, shouldering the burden for us. I don't think that will happen. So in that sense, I said before the elections, whoever wins, if Biden wins, it might be a difference in style rather than a difference in a lot of trends. And especially in the field of defense, for example, we will not get somebody who questions Article 5 of NATO. But we do get somebody who expects us, like Trump did, like Obama did, to pay our share. And for example, in Germany, Germany doesn't, the Netherlands doesn't either, but I think the Germans are lagging behind even more. I do hope that the in itself positive election of Joe Biden to the presidency of the United States doesn't mean that we don't continue, you know, strengthening European defense.
Yes, indeed. So thank you. This was an important warning that, you know, now is not the time to lean back and just relax in the hope that Joe Biden will fix it all. On the contrary, Trump's shock therapy was a useful wake-up call, and so we need to continue in Europe, which is, by the way, a view that I quite share. Now, at the same time, I have to say I see a lot of talk already by many, let's say, transatlanticists that, you know, essentially think now we go back to the pre-Trump era. But there's a number of, I think, structural reasons why that will not be the case and why it shouldn't be the case. And I think one important argument that I'm always making is that even though Biden has won, Donald Trump still got 71 million people voting for him. So the country is extremely divided. And who can guarantee to Europeans that in 4 years' time, you know, we won't see again a change towards someone who's perhaps more populist? So the political risk is actually quite high. And second reason why I think personally we need to continue strengthening our own defense and sovereignty more broadly is, of course, that any US president, no matter which party he belongs to, will, I think, focus more strongly on China in the coming years. So perhaps let me push you a little bit on sort of concrete action and where you see the EU in particular needs to act. I mean, also given that the US will look and is looking at China and is perhaps also decoupling economically more and more from China. What can we do as Europeans and what would be the right strategy?
I think you're quite right on your remark also on Joe Biden also having to focus on the internal discussion first, I think, before he gets to the external debate. Internally, we're moving from Make America Great Again to Buy American. So in that sense, the challenge is as big, and there's shifting panels on the global level. Where is Europe in all of this? The first thing that Europe has to do is also an internal thing. We need unity. If we are to play a role in this global game of shifting panels, and the panels might shift differently in different policy areas. We might get to climate, for example, later. But if Europe is to play a role in that game, it needs to be united first. Then on China, I see that there pretty much America and Europe, in terms of the economy and trade, have a common agenda in the sense that they want to level the playing field. This is key for me. This is key for the EPP in a lot of key dossiers, not only in trade, on climate as well. And if you want to level the playing field vis-a-vis China, you know, state-aided companies, foreign investment from China by state-aided companies into the EU, is it always in our strategic interest? Question one. Is it always fair? Question two. I think the answer to both questions is not automatically yes. It might be no. And if we want to level the playing field, we need to do it together with the US. Now, on other issues, we might or we will also need China when it comes to the climate, for example. Of course, Joe Biden will be more willing. He has said he will go back into the Paris Accords. That is fantastic. But he was very careful in saying anything about, for example, shale gas drilling, because he needed to win Pennsylvania. I've been there. I've seen what it does to a poor part of that state. Basically, there are no opportunities unless an oil company comes to your house and says, you will get $100,000 a year for 5 years if I can do a test drill installation in right. your backyard, and then you win the jackpot, and that's it. So he was very careful there, and we might need both. Now, well, then you're in the middle of the discussion about, do we potentially need a carbon border adjustment mechanism, something that was for years, you know, a no-go within the commission and a no-go within my own political family. But if you want to level the playing field, you shouldn't automatically discard those tools in your potential toolbox. But to cut it short, in the trade agenda, we need to cooperate very, very closely with the Americans. In other agenda, yeah. But that doesn't mean that you automatically close the door for China, because you might have strategic interests where Europe needs to work more closely with China.
Well, let's talk about the climate issues in a minute. Before that, I want to push you a bit more on the China issue and the level playing field issue and whether our agenda is really the same as the US agenda. First of all, on the level playing field, I think we all agree, and there's a commission white paper on how to use competition policy instruments more strongly to ensure that external companies coming into the European market with state aid from external actors, i.e. China, can be better policed and better controlled so as to level the playing field. So I think there a lot is happening, and I see that you are supportive of that. But is our strategy on China really the same as the US? I mean, if I look at the US and especially now what Donald Trump is doing and what I think will continue under Biden is really an attempt to decouple in at least specific sectors. For example, yesterday there was an executive White House decision to limit the capacity of American investors to invest into Chinese companies if they have links to the Chinese military, which, you know, many companies have somehow links to the military. It's a very strong decoupling strategy. And in the technology space, Trump is really trying, and I suspect Biden could continue, is really trying to create its own a separate ecosystem ecosystem where, you know, chip production is not done on both sides, but, you know, it's really separate and does not rely on the other side, and so on and so forth. So in the technology space, I think because of the risk of dual use, right? I mean, it's really, there's a really a push, and we don't know how Biden will play it, but it's a push to decoupling. And the European companies, they are really very deeply engaged on both sides. I mean, we have technological partnerships, we have business interests on both sides. So how are we going to play this out?
Yeah, indeed. How do we play this out in a way that we're not completely squeezed between these two giants? And that really gets back to my first remark, right? Which is the unity within the EU. You said, okay, we have this white paper now on the industrial and the competition policy and how to use that. But I still sense that not everyone, even at the top of the Commission, is in agreement how big a role competition policy, screening of state aid can play when it comes to these strategic issues. I think they are highly strategic. I was very happy with what Commission President von der Leyen said about it in her State of the Union speech. But I also hear Vice President Vestager immediately afterwards downplaying, you know, how big a role can competition policy, the monitoring of state aid actually play. So I think we have some homework to do. And then we're in the middle of the debate about the strategic sectors, right? Is it in our interest to be so dependent on whatever side it is when it comes to technology and dual use, technology that can be used for spying effectively? So we're in the middle of the Huawei debate. And you see that America, and I think Biden will continue to some degree, you see that America has been much more black and white and harsher in the conclusions that they drew. The UK as well. And even my own member state is not that clear. Of course, we've permanently copy the magical formula, which is that in the core of the system, we don't want foreign interference. So the core of the system, in plain English, we don't want to be built for 5G, for example, by Huawei. But we don't get any further than that. So I see this much more as a European homework issue than whether we need to look at the other parties, what they are doing. I think it's pretty clear what they are doing. And this is exactly linked to, I hope the election of Joe Biden doesn't lull us into complacency. I think we need to take steps, be more strategic. You mentioned the technology, so I'm answering the question in the field of technology. I think we need to be more strategic than we are now. And if that means that we, in all member states, exclude Huawei from the core of the 5G network, for me, that would be a perfectly logical conclusion.
Do you want to say one word on the Dutch decision not to allow the investment into the chip factory in the Netherlands? There was a lot of US pressure on it. Was it the right decision?
Well, there you saw exactly what we get into if we are being squeezed between the US and China. And at a European level, we need to organize ourselves in such a way that we don't get into that position again. You can argue in many ways, and I don't want to discuss the particular case, but for me, it is an illustration of what happens if we allow ourselves to be the midget in the middle of two giants. The Iran sanctions is another key example of how something that was in the American interest, was America-led, hurt a lot of European companies. Now, you know, we need to draw some conclusions from both of those examples.
So again, one more question before I come to climate. And it's not because I want to sort of deprioritize climate, but I want to pick up on your point on the unity, which I think is, I mean, of course, we all agree with that. But, you know, the reality is we don't have that at the moment on some issues. And there's different views on how to overcome the problem. And concretely, I mean, when it comes to this investment screening mechanism, one of the tricky issues is that it boils down, these kind of security considerations boil down to, in the end, national decisions. So even though an investment is an investment into not just a country, but an investment into a single market, so an investment into all of the EU, the decision whether or not this is problematic from a security point of view still largely remains a national one. So how can we really solve this? And should we eventually move to some sort of qualified majority voting on these issues? Or are you more on the side of European Council President Charles Michel, who was sort of very much advocating for unanimity in these kind of decisions? I mean, so how do we play out on these things?
Well, there's a lot of interrelated issues here. I agree with you that on the decision whether something is strategic, and the strategic analysis is very much still at the national level. Let me take one step back. The fact that we now have legislation about investment screening is a first. It is a side effect, by the way, in my view, of Brexit, because it was always the UK stopping this kind of debate, helped by my member state, the Netherlands. And when we were discussing this legislation, you could see now that the UK was not there, the Netherlands suddenly became relatively pragmatic on this issue. So a lot of these strategic considerations, they were always much more pressing in the east of Europe than they were in the west. And I think in this dossier, you saw that finally also, the Netherlands saw the need to not always only think economically, but also strategically. I highly welcome that. Is the legislation enough? No, it is not. One thing that we need to do very, very quickly is to make sure that we vote by qualified majority when it comes to the sanctions, the analysis of third countries. This is an interlinked issue. Because whenever we want to discuss the Uyghurs in China, for example, those member states who have a high level of foreign investment from China are always the ones that are saying, careful, 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 don't do it. So the first step is to, at least in that area, sanctions, positions vis-a-vis third countries, to move very quickly to qualified majority voting. This is not what you were referring to. You were referring to actually having qualified majority voting when it comes to the analysis. This is either yes or no in our strategic interest. And even further is the question if you can then also force member states to act accordingly. For me, we need to build on the legislation that we currently have on the screening of strategic investments. It needs to become stronger. It needs to foresee a bigger role for the European Commission and for the community method when it comes to the analysis. And I'm happy to also have that analysis decision be taken by qualified majority. Now, when you then go into the discussion of in how far can you force member states to act accordingly, you might be on your way to have a discussion about treaty change, which is always cheerful, difficult at a European level. But let me say this, I think what we currently have is not enough. And we need to bring more commonness into the system, into the analysis. What we also try to do from the side of the EPP is to say that in the recovery and resilience facility, we should make sure, the Commission should make sure, from the side of the Parliament, we want a strong role for the Commission in analyzing the national plans. Council thinks differently. They would prefer a blank check. I think we need strong European oversight here to make sure the money is well spent. And one of the criteria that we suggested the Commission take on board, we as an EPP, is to say we should not spend European money into the strategic plans of other continents. In plain English, One Belt, One Road. Why would we co-finance the strategic interests of China, mainly in the east of Europe, with European money? So I think this is a very legitimate question to ask, and the EPP did so. It is linked to my own personal experience when I went to China with the presidency of the EPP group. We were received at the headquarters of Costco, the big shipping company, China Ocean Shipping Company. And you're always welcomed by one of the welcoming committee, welcoming staff. And he made the joke, across the street, there is the Chinese Central Bank. And in China, they say, if you're close to a bank, you will always have fortune. Fortune in the sense of luck. But yes, they will always have fortune because they have been rescued on several occasions by the state, by pouring money into it from the Chinese state. And once we got upstairs to the boardroom, and the serious talks started. Very enlightening, by the way, for Europeans to be in a boardroom where you see the map of the world with China in the middle. The first question that came up by one of the big shots from Costco was, we've bought half of the port of Piraeus. When can we buy the other half? And can we please have Juncker fund money to create a railway from Piraeus through the Balkans, you know, into the heart of Europe, into the heart of the European economy. And then you sit there as a Dutch member of the European Parliament, you look at that map, you realize what it does. If you shorten the trip from China of a container, a sea container, to Piraeus instead of Antwerp, Rotterdam, Hamburg, and you really wonder, why is this debate, this was, you know, 4 years ago, why is this debate not taking place in Belgium, in the Netherlands, not enough in any case, in Germany? So really, I think this example very much underlines why we need to start thinking more strategically and not economy only.
Fascinating. I mean, this is a wonderful example of strategic autonomy and why our discussion is still not where it should be. But I think we are moving there, as you described. Let's talk a bit about the climate issue, because that's, I think, one of the big agenda items for, well, the next decades, actually. I mean, it's not just for the next years, but something where we will see a marked difference between a Trump president and Mr. Biden. Mr. Biden has announced that he wants to take tough climate action. At the same time, he might not win the Senate, so some of the issues might not be that easy for him domestically actually to implement, and that has repercussions also for Europe and for the Green Deal. So where do you see this climate discussion playing? How will it play out, and what should Europe really prioritize vis-a-vis the US?
Well, my son would now tell you it depends on the Georgia runoff, right, in January for the Senate. But indeed, it is tight, and there might not be a Democratic majority in the Senate. This is nothing new. You know, I remember the Clinton administration and Kyoto, and Clinton signed, but the Senate refused to go along. So in the end, they never joined, you know, so, or that Senate didn't allow him to in any case. So this is nothing new. This is an inbuilt part of the checks and balances in the American system. It does mean that Europe needs to keep several options on the table. Yes, it makes it easier that Joe Biden has said that he will return to the Paris Agreement. But we don't know, like you say, what will happen in internal politics and whether he can get supported also by the Senate. That means the proposal of, for example, a carbon border adjustment mechanism was the right one. No matter how difficult the discussion will be, the discussion at a political level, whether you want this or not, at the level of the economic interests, it's a big difference whether you're an importing company, an exporting company. I won't go into the details, but we need to have this because it forces other parts of the world to follow our argument. This is about, you know, being not squeezed by the other big parties in the world. They need to show us whether they have a similar system to our ETS system, whether they have a system that will price the emission of carbon, or whether they don't. So the carbon border adjustment mechanism idea does two things. It either forces the others to have a similar system and then you don't need it, or other parts of the world don't have similar systems and then you do need it very, very badly in order to get this level playing field. So we need to be open for all these options. And here I have a similar analysis than when it comes to defense, is that I don't hope that now the pressure is off for issues like carbon border adjustment, because people think, Joe Biden is going to rejoin Paris. And, you know, we don't need to talk about awful things which we naturally don't like a carbon border adjustment mechanism. My signal is, yes, we will need to continue with this, to have it in our toolbox, just in case, after the honeymoon phase with Joe Biden, it turns out that the Senate doesn't leave him any room, for example.
Well, I have to say on this border carbon adjustment, I'm a bit more pessimistic than you are.
I know.
I see the logic of it. And, you know, I think we need it from an economic point of view. But I think we will not be able to do it if the US doesn't play along. because we have tried, you might remember the instance when we tried to extend the ETS system, so the emission trading system, to the airline sector. And, you know, there was so much political pressure, including from major buyers of our Airbus, that we basically couldn't pull it through. And so I find it difficult to see how Europe will be able to do it against the pressure of China and the United States. And I think a lot of people in China are now quite worried that with the Biden administration, Europe and the US will pull it through together and then, you know, leave China out of the game. And that would be an interesting constellation, of course, and almost like the old TTIP idea, but in a very different field, namely in the climate field, bringing the US and Europe together to set a global standard, basically. So that would be an amazing success. But as you say, it really depends on domestic politics in the US and how this will play out.
Let me say, I know this is hard. And I am convinced that on the upper floors of the Berlin Wall, let's put it that way, not just one floor, but several floors, they look at this instrument as something that hopefully they may not need. I think that would be the ultimate goal. I'm just not convinced that it will be that easy, you know, that just threatening to have an adjustment at the border will convince others to play along when it comes to standards for CO2 emissions and the climate. And the reason why I'm so insistent, if you give me another instrument that does the same job, I'm happy too. Huh? It doesn't need to be this instrument. But the reason why I'm so insistent is that this level playing field really, I think, is at the core of the debate when it comes to European industrial policy and also of the Green Deal. If the Green Deal means that basically we will buy cheap electrical buses from China, the Green Deal will fail. I made the experience in my own country in the Netherlands. We did for 3-4 regions, so a big chunk of our country, we needed to do a new tender for the provision of public transport. So, you know, goody two shoes as we are, we already included the climate considerations into that tender, and we wanted the buses to be electrical. So we wanted clean public transport for that region. In the end, the company that won the tender, it turned out that, and this wasn't even known during the process, it was a European company, but they would end up buying the buses in China. In the end, that turned out to be secret side letters, etc. I won't go into the details, but this is exactly my worry. I don't necessarily need a Dutch company to make these buses, although I know of a company that could, but I also know of a Belgian company or a German company. And if in the end I get buses from a Chinese company that gets loads of state aid, as a result of which they can completely outcompete our European producers, then it won't work. It won't work because the Green Deal won't provide the jobs that we need in Europe. We are promising our people, yes, some jobs may be lost in the coal industry, for example, but you will get new jobs in return. We need to deliver on that premise. And the only way we can do that is by leveling the playing field and making sure our companies have a fair chance. So really, for the EPP, this goes to the heart of the matter, not only fairness within trade, but also I don't see the Green Deal succeed if we don't fix this. And the same discussion we will get in the revision of the ETS next year.
I mean, just to push back a bit on this point, and then we have to close, unfortunately. Yeah. But, I mean, what speaks against cheap buses or cheap solar panels from China? I mean, that helps us actually to be able to afford our energy transition in the first place. I mean, I would have a problem if the level playing field gets distorted in a permanent way by sort of massive state subsidization destroying our industry here. At that stage, we have a problem. But a cheap bus or cheap solar panel can also be just a result of Chinese having bigger scale in the production, perhaps more efficient production methods, or many other reasons. I mean, competition from China is going to be tough, and it's a normal thing to have competition. So I'm a little bit worried that what you just said is perhaps a tit too much of a protectionist agenda instead of just a level playing field agenda.
Well, of course, you need competition to stay competitive. Right? I don't belong to the school of thought that thinks you can pick champions. You know, we in Brussels, we say, you are now a champion. It doesn't work that way. Champions become champions because they train. They want to get better in sports as well as in business. So don't get me wrong there. But these buses are potentially cheaper because of the humongous amount of state aid that is poured into the company. It might be a deliberate strategy, as with the solar panels, to, for a number of years, put them on the market under the production price in order to make sure that the European producers disappear. And then once you have the market, you know, you're free to set the price. So this is, again, strategic thinking. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to, you know, if a Chinese company is the best because they are the best, and as a result, they have the economies of scale and the better research, and they provide the best product for the best price, you won't hear me. My only complaint is, in a lot of situations, the buses, I think there's proof in the solar panels as well, it's not done on a fair basis and a basis of a level playing field. And believe me, I had to explain this to Dutch farmers who were very supportive of the cheap Chinese solar panels, because they would put their all their sheds, cover them in solar panels, which is a good thing, by the way. And of course, if the cheapest ones are from China, they wanted them. But I did vote in favor of the anti-dumping measures at the time, because I do believe there was proof of dumping, and then we should act. It's as plain as simple as that.
Esther De Lange, thank you so much. We could continue for another hour, but it was a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us on The Sound of Economics. And if you would like to listen to more podcasts, please go to our website on www.bruegel.org and follow us on various social media channels. Thank you again, Mrs. De Lange.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much.